Dr. Smith. Maybe a couple of seconds and I will.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning, and welcome to the first episode of A View From Afar for 2021. And today, as always, we are joined by political scientist and former Pentagon analyst Paul Buchanan. And this week, we will discuss Australia and New Zealand. Are these two Pacific nations culturally and politically too distant and different to sustain their traditional special relationship? The latest spat between New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern and Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison involves Australia acting in bad faith, in effect cancelling the citizenship of an alleged terrorist sympathiser so that New Zealand is forced to relocate her and her two children. Also, in Australia, centre-right commentators have labelled Jacinda Ardern's New Zealand government as socialist and siding with China over the Australian and PRC's diplomatic and trade battles. Can the AU-NZ special relationship be salvaged, or has it gone too far? But first, here's an invitation to those of you who are joining us live right now. If you are joining us via Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, feel free to make comments. If you do, we'll be able to include your interactions in this program. So let's cross over to Paul and get discussing this big, big South Pacific and Trans-Tasman issue. Good afternoon, Paul.
Kia ora, Selwyn, and a very belated Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you too, Paul. It's great to have us back together discussing these kind of foreign affairs, security, intelligence issues, foreign policy issues that are impacting around the world and particularly on the South Pacific and New Zealand. Paul, what do you make of this issue? What do you see the trends being with respect to the special relationship between Australia and New Zealand, and also this issue of the alleged woman terrorist that Australia cancelled her citizenship and forced New Zealand to put in play measures to have her relocated to New Zealand and her two children?
Well, let me start with the first one. The broader issue is Australia and New Zealand have been drifting apart. I mean, you could call it the continental drift that separated them in the first place, pretty much since the end of the Commonwealth. I mean, I know the Commonwealth exists still as an entity, but they've been drifting further and further apart over the years, and that has accelerated as both countries began to expand their trade relationships outside of the traditional alliance structure that they used to belong to, the Anglophone alliance structure, if you will. And even though they're still partners when it comes to military affairs, and certainly as part of the Five Eyes signals intelligence networks, both demographically and politically, these countries are no longer as close as they used to be. And so that's become a source of friction, particularly when one country is being governed by a right-leaning government and the other one's being governed by a left-leaning government, which is the case today. So if you think about the Australians' desire is to become the deputy sheriff in the Southern Hemisphere to the United States, replacing England as the United States' best security ally. And they're well on their way to that. Right now in the Southern Hemisphere, Australia hosts the most U.S. troops of any other country.
And more than the southern parts of the African Union, more than these southern American states is included, yeah?
More than anything in South America, more than anything in sub-Saharan Africa, even though there's some big commands there. I mean, the Australians have a Marine Expeditionary Force in Darwin. I mean, this is, you know, two brigades worth of Marines. And then the naval facilities, I don't know if you and I have talked about this, but the United States is set to recreate the first fleet, something that was disbanded in the early 1970s, and they're going to home port that fleet, which means a carrier and all of its complement, somewhere in and around Australia. Darwin being one of the ports, Perth being another, all as part of the containment policy on China. Now, in contrast, there's little old New Zealand that wants to remain independent in global affairs, which wants to downplay its military and intelligence ties to the United States, precisely because, whether true or not, it believes itself to be an honest broker as a small independent state in global affairs.
Well, on that point, it can either be lost within the mix or it can establish its identity and its independence. And I think what we're seeing is some evidence of that, yeah?
Yeah, I tend to think that we here in New Zealand exaggerate the that line that we punch above our weight in international relations. I think if we try to get into the middle as an honest broker or mediator between the Australians and China, since relations between those two states are quite tense at the moment, or China and the United States, we'll get laughed out of the room. I mean, once the big players start, you know, dealing with each other in earnest bilaterally, there's no place for New Zealand, quite frankly. I'm saying that, you know, wearing my realist.
But we're not there yet. And in that medium term, and where New Zealand is located at the moment, then surely New Zealand has a position to actually assert where it can that honest broker label. It has done it in the past. It is connected, like we spoke of on numerous occasions last year, some major powers relating to the Korean Peninsula in the 2000s. We've played our part, if you like, with respect to Iran and the Middle East as well. So New Zealand has a role in that honest broker part. And my argument, Paul, would be that you cannot assert that without an overt culture of independence. And I think that's what's driving New Zealand government to be so staunch against the Australians at this time as well.
Yeah, and I think that you're absolutely right that New Zealand, it can play a strong role as a honest, you know, mediator, interlocutor. But I think the key here is that it also must represent a voice for the South Pacific community. Mm. The Australians are drifting away from the Pacific Island Forum, from the South Pacific Conference, the traditional aggregators of Pacific Island nation interests. And New Zealand remains as the most articulate spokesperson for the collective interests. Obviously, each state has its own particular interests, but certainly with the advancing competition of the United States and China and the South Pacific, New Zealand has a significant role to play there, in part because the Australians have abdicated that role. So I think that there's plenty of room for New Zealand to maneuver. I just think once, what's that old saying? Whether or not the elephants are fighting or making love, the mice have to be careful.
You like that saying, Paul. You've used it in the past.
It comes from Lee Kuan Yew, so it must be my
Singapore
that brought that to the fore.
Yeah, look, the Guardian has wrapped up a bit of a video here on Jacinda Ardern and the Australian Stout. I'd just like to play this so that we can see what the overseas and international kind of media, how they're handling this particular thing as well.
Our very strong view on behalf of New Zealand and New Zealanders was that this individual was clearly most appropriately dealt with by Australia. That is where their family resides, that is where their links reside, and that is the place from which they departed for Syria. I raised that issue directly with PM Morrison and asked that we work together on resolving the issue. I was then informed in the following year that Australia had unilaterally revoked the citizenship of the individual involved. You can imagine my response. Since that time, we have continually raised with Australia our view that their decision was wrong. We continue to raise that view. My concern, however, now is that we have a situation where someone is now detained with two small children. My focus is on resolving this issue with the best interests of the children in mind, whilst continuing to making very strong representations to Australia about their responsibility here.
Well, my job is Australia's interests. That's my job. And it's my job as the Australian Prime Minister to put Australia's national security interests first. So I think all Australians would agree with that. Now, the legislation that was passed through our Parliament automatically cancels the citizenship of a dual citizen where they've been engaged in terrorist activities of this nature.
I think New Zealand, frankly, is tired of having Australia export its problems. But now there are two children involved. And so we have to resolve this issue with the interest of those children in mind.
Yeah, Paul. So on the front of this, what I'm picking up, and correct me if I'm wrong here, and I'm sure you will, is that we've got now in New Zealand a Prime Minister whose party does not require a coalition to exist. That the Labour Party that is led by Jacinda Ardern is her government. She is no longer sharing the requirements and necessity of other parties, like in the last term with New Zealand First, and its more conservative centrist kind of positions, to assert her brand New Zealand. And I think what we're seeing here is an issue that has come up. Obviously, it's been in play for some time, that Jacinda Ardern knows that this is right at the heart of the issues that she is most concerned about and has perhaps positioned her political brand around, and indeed what she thinks is sincerely wrong. And that's particularly, like she emphasised there, that with two children in play here, as well as a woman, that the Australians have acted in bad faith and quite frankly just quite wrong, as she says. So I see also that we're seeing a more assertive Prime Minister. In history here, I have not seen in my lifetime a New Zealand Prime Minister, or perhaps with the exclusion of David Longhi, a New Zealand Prime Minister appear to be so annoyed at the Australians' actions, and also this action of bad faith positioning that Australia allegedly has taken on. What do you make of it? That's where I see this as being played out. I think it's a sincere response by Jacinda Ardern. It's one where she is no longer tolerant to the Australians looking like they're the big ones on the block and New Zealand being subservient, and she's calling a spade a spade.
Yeah, I tend to agree with her. I would say that Prime Minister Morrison is lying through his teeth when he says that he's protecting the national security of Australia, because the woman in question, and I'll talk about her in a second, is not a terrorist. In fact, he's defaming her by calling her that. This was all about his domestic political considerations. And what Jacinda Ardern has done, and this dates back to the March 15th terrorist attack, her response to crisis in general, is she plays humanitarian interests first and foremost. And who wouldn't when you have children involved? Yeah. I mean, these kids, you know, are innocents. So I think what we're getting here is getting to the straw that broke the camel's back. It's an accumulation of offenses on the part of the Australians towards New Zealand. The mistreatment of Kiwis in Australia, the denial of some basic rights, even though they may be dual citizens, even though they may have lived there for very long periods of time, the exportation of criminals from Australia back to New Zealand because they were born in New Zealand, although yeah. some of them have never really lived there. I think she's had enough of this.
Yeah, and you're making reference to that Australian practice and policy and law where if a New Zealander was born, if an individual was born in New Zealand, they may have left New Zealand when they were 6 months old. In the case of this yes. alleged terrorist woman, 6 years old, they go to Australia, they may have developed a life of crime. If they've committed crimes and they are falling within the scope of the Australian deportation laws, out ski they go, they're on a plane to New Zealand, irrespective of whether or not they've got any ties or anybody to pick them up at the airport, and bang, they're looking around and thinking, where are we now? Now, Scott Morrison's argument is, clearly, that it's in Australia's national interest and domestic interest to actually revoke citizenships where it believes they're being abused. And that's the end of the story with them. I'll just bring in, first off, a couple of comments that have come in here. One here, let's just see if we got one from Chris Minto. Scott Morrison is the kind of guy who happily takes his neighbour's lawnmower, breaks it, throws it back over the fence, and sends his neighbour the bill. You know, so that's a good, strong, well-articulated comment. And I think, Chris, that actually represents the common feeling in New Zealand at this particular time over this particular issue. There's another comment that has come in too. I'll just bring Chris's one down. And that is coming in from David Mooring. It's the two children which makes this a moral issue. At the very least, both Australia and New Zealand should be offering them entry to the country. So, Paul, you know, those comments have come in, one from Facebook, one from YouTube. They're right on mark, aren't they? People have given this a lot of thought. They obviously see the issue here being one of moral choice. It may be legal for Australia, for Australia's Prime Minister, to actually dump people or to, in bad faith, box New Zealand into an international law position where it has to take people on. But it doesn't make it right.
No, you're absolutely right. And let me break down the state of play with regards to this woman. So as you just said, you know, she emigrated to Australia when she was six, along with her parents. She has no ties to speak of in New Zealand anymore. Her parents were refugees themselves from Northern Africa. She was socialized in Australia. She apparently speaks with a Melbourne accent. And she was radicalized in Australia. But as many teenagers do, she departed the family home as soon as she was emancipated. So at the age of 18, and she decamped using a Australian passport to make her way to Turkey, where she was smuggled into Syria. There she mothered, she gave birth to three kids, one of whom died at a young age of pneumonia. She had two husbands, both apparently Swedes, who were both killed in the fighting. There is no evidence that she was involved in any crime. She was a supporter and a sympathizer of ISIS, as far as an 18 or 19-year-old or 20-year-old could tell. And let's be very clear. She apparently went there in 2014-15. She had three kids. She was pregnant for 27 months out of the 5 years. Okay, so 2 years and 3 months. She was nurturing those kids pretty much from, you know, within a year of getting to Syria. And on top of all of this, in an interview she gave with the ABC, once they discovered her in a refugee camp on the Turkish border, she said that she tried to leave when she got to Turkey. She didn't like what she was seeing. She attempted to leave. She called her mother saying, "Mom, I want to leave. Not a good situation."
Her mother in Australia?
Yes. And so this should be documented. This should be provable. But the key here is she then goes on to say that she was forced to go into Syria against her wishes and become a jihadi bride. Well, quite frankly, Selwyn, that's like being forced into some type of sex slave status. Yeah. It was against her consent. So that changes everything with regards to her. And again, she's not been charged with any crime. The Australians have put out an Interpol blue notice, which is They were seeking information about her whereabouts, I think because they were wondering if she was in a refugee camp. That's not a red notice, which is an arrest warrant. So there's no indications that she committed any crime other than some really poor judgment as a teenager. And now she wants to get back out. She openly walked across the border with these two small kids. She
from wasn't Syria, hiding. From Syria in a refugee camp to Turkey. So what's Turkey's response here?
Well, the Turks, see, it's interesting about the Turks. They have made this problem. Remember, most of the ISIS fighters transited through Turkey on their way into Syria, and Turkey cast a blind eye because Turkey doesn't have much love for the Assad regime. And so they were sympathetic to the ISIS fighters who were fighting against Assad in the first instance before the West got involved. And now they have a buffer zone along the common border between Syria and Turkey that extends 20 miles into Syria. That's where these refugee camps are. The irony is that they've de facto become the sovereign of that buffer zone. Even the Russians won't go in there. They've cut a deal with the Turks. And so now they have a humanitarian crisis on their borders. So anyone who is not a Syrian or a Turk who transits across those borders, the first move is to charge them with illegal entry. And if they're from some other place, deport them to that place. And that's where it gets interesting, because the Australian move to revoke her passport and strip her of her citizenship is legally challengeable on several fronts. They denied her due process. They denied her the right to appeal. We don't know, for example, the circumstances of her departure from Australia. What if it's the case that family members pressured her to join the fight in Syria and that she had to go because of her status in that? We don't know any of that.
We don't know. We don't know. So these mitigating elements which have not come through into the public sphere, at least, maybe they've been well looked at and threshed out by the government agencies like MFAT and the intelligence agencies, for example. Paul, I've got a couple of other comments that have come in. We'll just look at those. They're a bit tongue-in-cheek, actually. You know, that what they're doing is they're reflecting the New Zealand, let's just bring it up, reflecting the New Zealand position in the past where Australia has got a bit assertive against New Zealand's interests. As for quotes, David Mooring puts here, New Zealand to Australian migration raises the IQ on both sides of the Tasman. And that was Robert Muldoon going right back. And I think, you know, this is one of the tongue-in-cheek jabs here. We've got one from Kevin Hester here, a journalist, a brief word, Prime Minister, David Longy, wombat. Courtesy of Martin Cahill. You know, these are some of the historical kind of things coming through. Then, you know, here's a word, you know, this is people are obviously upset about this. Martin Cahill, he's talking about Scott Morrison, the Australian Prime Minister here. He's the latest in a line of crap Prime Ministers. You know, so I think what that reflects is some dissatisfaction, perhaps, with the positions that Scott Morrison has taken, and obviously people have got strong views. Now, Paul, what it's doing here is I'll just bring up on screen this culture of how Australia regards New Zealand. I'll just see if we can play this clip here. And this is Sky News, perhaps the more centre-right, right-leaning kind of forums that Australia has here. And it's saying New Zealand will become a vassal state of China, and on it goes. Now, here are these two commentators
part of
here.
Being mates, you've got to look each other in the eye and go, come on, mate. You're dancing with, in this case, the wrong partner. Probably time to step back a little here. I'm concerned about this because ANZUS is 7 years this year, and Five Eyes, they are part of the elite club of Western nations that agree they are on the same page. And on the opposite side of the page at the moment is China.
Well, China is the problem. And you will recall, let me start right from the beginning, that my affection for the New Zealand people is more than just cursory, because my granddaughter is half New Zealand.
Of course, yeah.
Angela's late husband, of course, was a New Zealander. So our ties are very strong. But when it comes to the New Zealand government, that's different. And they are a socialist government. And they have turned their back on us as a partner in that sense, to side up with the Chinese Communist Party. This is the party that has concentration camps for the Uyghur people. Mm-hmm. This is the party that trades in body parts. This is the party that not only has stomped on any democracy in Hong Kong, but now has the disappeared. So this is the people they prefer to sidle up to, rather than understand that Australia is standing up for our rights.
So, Paul, you can get the feeling of some of the more right-leaning commentators and where they're taking the narrative on this particular issue. And what they were addressing there is New Zealand government, first our Minister of Trade, Damien O'Connor, and secondly the Prime Minister, basically giving Australian government a little bit of a lesson in its negotiations or its diplomacy with the People's Republic of China. Australia obviously didn't like that, and that's going back a few weeks before this latest stout. So what this leads me to raise here is getting back to that primary question. Where is the special relationship located now? Where was it in the past? And where do you believe is it tracking? Is it salvageable, or is the special relationship with Australia, we're too distant, too different, and it's dead in the water?
Well, I don't think it's entirely dead, but I think that the two countries, although they face similar problems in terms of demographic change and, you know, the literal faces of these nations are changing dramatically and quickly. It's in the policy response, pardon me, where things have changed. The Australians, in a weird way, especially under these liberal governments, are doing a version of Trump's MAGA. They're trying to reclaim a past glory, reassert the supremacy of the post-colonialists in the face of massive waves of immigration from Asia and other places, and of course, their very sorry history with regards to the original settlers of the land. New Zealand's going the other way. We're diversifying. The influence of Pakeha is diminishing every single year because we're giving more space to people of color, certainly women. New Zealand has an incredible record when it comes to women in power. And so the two countries right there, the policy responses to the changing political demographic that goes with, you know, the actual sociological change, is forcing this divide. And again, we are less attuned to the United States demands than the Australians are. I did find it, well, I found, quite frankly, the Sky clip to be nothing more than rubbish.
Yeah.
But let's just put it this way. New Zealand is one of the most deregulated market economies in the world, much less so than Australia. So calling New Zealand socialist is rubbish. Again, this
You've picked up on an issue here, I think, that's at the basis of this. Australia's response, and you touched on it right at the beginning of this episode. Australia has a centre-right government. It's got certainly a centre-right, if not right, coalition with the Nationals, which is a rural-based party in Australia. So the Liberals, to be in power, they are in coalition with the Nationals, which are, some would say, are rednecks. If they're kind of stereotype, that some would say. New Zealand, on the other hand, has got a very popular and, you know, influential prime minister on the global stage that has made a career and made a prime ministership, a leadership, out of, like what you put earlier on, a humanitarian issues come first, and a compassion obviously is there. What is the right thing to do is often in the decision making. She's obviously Labour Party, which is quite different to the National Party that was in government in New Zealand prior to Jacinda Ardern coming through in the last two terms. I cannot see that Sky commentators would have taken New Zealand on that ridiculous journey of labelling us as led by a socialist government if the National Party was still in power in New Zealand. I think it's a clash of political ideologies that is going on here, and it's ridiculous. I agree with you there, and clearly and frankly, the Australians are getting desperate and trying to actually assert what's... just to recap on that, I don't think that it would have been unusual to New Zealand 8 years ago for the same kind of commentary to be here on our mainstream news.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, you are correct. There are two different visions of the proper society operating in these two countries. And I don't like the terms progressive and regressive because they imply too much. But I would say if progressive is to embrace the changes that are occurring underneath you, that is, you know, we need immigrants. You know, the society is changing. Its values, the core values remain. But kids today are subject to many other influences. A progressive embraces them and steers them in the direction of good. A regressive rejects them and tries to cling to a past that may never exist. If you ask non-white Australians how things were in the 50s and 60s, you're going to get a very different response than the white elites in Sydney or even Canberra. So, yeah. You know, I think the difference lies there. And
I'll just pick up on the progressive thing too. Like you know, Paul, I did about 10 years, a little bit over 10 years of weekly radio show in Australia, one of the prominent radio stations over there. Over that decade, not the host, not the guy that I dealt with and was on air with, but others in the station turned progressive into basically a swear word, a word that was offensive, a word that had been eroded, redefined to mean something that was quite alien to those that perhaps would exert and develop progressive politics. And you could see the seeding of this kind of narrative. I suggest that in Australia's mainstream media, this is very, very, you know, common practice, where now the dominant narrative is something that's quite different to what we are observing in New Zealand. We get back to reflections of our culture. Are they reflecting the overall culture in Australia? There'll be large segments of Australia say, hey, hey, no, they don't speak for us. And that's fair enough. But I've got a few other comments that have come in, Paul. I'll just bring them up on screen. And the first is here from Genevieve McLean. And does acceptance of this woman and her children set a difficult precedent for others who have made bad choices or want to come home? I think that deserves a bit of an answer from you, Paul, there. She's clearly right on base with that.
Yeah, thanks, Genevieve. It's going to have to be a case-by-case basis. The background is this. There's about a dozen women who have left. They all left from Australia, but who have the same dual citizenship as this particular woman. They've gone to Syria. Their whereabouts are unknown. Some of them may be dead. I explained this to someone yesterday that, you know, the ISIS fights dirty and we're using civilians as human shields. In a lot of the battles with the Syrian army as well as the Western coalition. So we're not entirely sure that all of the Kiwi-born women who left are alive today, and whether or not they're in a refugee camp is an open question, which is why they're being sought. Each one has a different story to tell. I tend to doubt, given ISIS's medieval ideology, that any of them were fighters. They were brought there to breed future generations of ISIS sympathizers and fighters. You know, a most unfortunate circumstance. The female fighters in ISIS, as far as I understand, were Chechnyans. You know, very, very different kettle of fish. And there weren't large numbers of them either. Most of them were widows who had fought. Their husbands had died fighting the Russians. So they were very motivated to hurt Westerners and Russians in particular. None of these women fit that bill. And so as each one emerges, should they emerge, and again, I don't think all 12 will be alive, we need to consider their cases. They undoubtedly will have children. The issue, I think, is this. If there's evidence that any of the women participated in criminal activity, crimes against humanity, war crimes, anything of the sort, they need to be dealt with as criminals. And there's plenty of laws on both sides of the Tasman Sea to deal with that. You see, that's the other thing. I happen to have monitored right-wing websites and media yesterday to see the response here in New Zealand. And the levels of ignorance, bigotry, and racism is truly astounding here in New Zealand. Yeah. Because what people don't understand is if this woman were to come back, and any of the others were to come back, and this case is a precedent, the issue is this. Under the Terrorism Suppression Act of 2002 and its various amendments, she can be detained at the border if there's evidence she participated in a crime. If there is no evidence that she participated in a crime, that she's suspected of being a sympathizer, she can be subject to what are known as Control Act provisions, house arrest, no access to computers, no association with people who are known to have extremist views. She's not going to just go scot-free. Mm. And obviously, she will be interrogated at some length, and I'm sure that process has already begun in Turkey, about what she knew, who she knew, where are the other Australian and New Zealand women. All of that is valuable information for our security agencies. So this idea that somehow she's going to come back and pose a threat to either Australia or New Zealand is utter nonsense. And that's even before we get into talking about the fate of the kids. These kids are more than likely to have been traumatized by their life experiences in a war zone. The eldest is 5. The youngest, remember, the third one died. The youngest is 18 months. Yeah. They have a chance to make a life for themselves, and it's not going to be in Syria. So we need to put the interests of the children first and foremost, because we know that the mother will be monitored wherever she goes. But I tend to agree with our Prime Minister here in New Zealand. This is the Australians' responsibility first and foremost, and they're shirking their responsibility and in a weird way, betraying their own citizens because they stripped her of citizenship without due process, without the right of appeal. And in liberal democracies, that simply is not on. And it's challengeable. This could go to the International Court of Justice. If New Zealand decides to take legal remedy, it'll go to the ICJ. And I'm willing to bet that New Zealand would win any case involving where this woman should wind up.
There's a few threads of actions that the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has alluded to. At least in abstract, and keeping options open here. So perhaps that is among them. We've got a couple of other comments. It's a comment from Genevieve McLean that put a question just prior to this. That's a leap. She's referring to the Australians' Sky News commentators saying that New Zealand was basically a socialist government that sided with China and then listed a litany of China's human rights abuses. That's a leap, Genevieve says, from New Zealand's socialism to the CCP. And, you know, there are many in New Zealand that would agree with you there, that's for sure, Genevieve. And also there's a bit of a question here from David, who's also been active in the program. Is there any action that people can take, e.g. social media campaign, through a social-led trade boycott? I guess those are issues that are in the hands of common people. You know, if the boycotts are obviously an effective political tool where it's seemed and deemed necessary, it's up to the people to kind of organise that, isn't it? I can't see that New Zealand's trade and Australia's trade relationships, its closer economic relationships, are going to be affected by this. But, you know, the consumers, well, if they feel impassioned who can say?
Yeah, I mean, a boycott might work. If you don't like Australian Vegemite, you might want to
decide. A bit too salty or something.
But you know what? We could just highlight Australia's abysmal history when it comes to the treatment of asylum seekers. They imprison asylum seekers on remote Pacific islands.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was a bit rich for you know, those Sky TV commentators to actually address human rights when we've got human rights issues that Australia is actually committing here that have been addressed in the public sphere many, many, many times.
Part of the tensions, I mean, I'll leave aside again the treatment of Indigenous people in Australia. Just going to leave that one aside. Part of the tensions with China are because after elite Australian soldiers were charged with war crimes by their own defense investigators, multiple war crimes committed in Afghanistan, including the murder of unarmed civilians, the Chinese decided to take the mickey out of the Australians by publishing what were clearly offensive cartoons. They were designed to offend. And the Australians reacted very poorly to that. The point simply is that it's rich for the Australians to start talking about human rights and what have you when they haven't cleaned up their own shop. They're not comparable to China either. But I think that once you start saying that New Zealand is kowtowing, we must remember New Zealand is a very small place that depends a lot on its trade with Asia, including China. And because of that, we have to tread quite delicately when it comes to these sort of issues. And so even though I wouldn't have agreed with the trade minister's remarks about how the Australians might take a page out of New Zealand's book, and when it comes to dealing with China, the fact is that, let's just say that honey is oftentimes a lot more useful than vinegar when it comes to interstate relations, and the Aussies might wise up to that.
Yeah. Okay, on that point, Paul, let's wrap this program up. Thank you again for your company through the last 45 minutes. And thank you to those people who have commented into our program and also really led the reactions, mostly from a New Zealand point of view, of course. So thanks again. We'll be back this time next week with another issue in the foreign policy, intelligence and security space, where Paul Buchanan and I, Selwyn Manning, will get down deep into those issues. So thanks again. All the best and have a good and safe week.